Thank you. Thank you, Steve, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this is my second time before your group. Quite some time ago, I spoke when I think this was something of a new idea. And I want you to know that this makes this a double pleasure, because one of the things that I think affects most speakers and that upsets them the most is when they find themselves in strange surroundings and before a group, and they know little of the purposes of the group, and still they must establish a rapport and go ahead with a speech. Along that line, I keep thinking of a man, friend of mine, who was a clergyman, and he made his first trip to New York City. He knew very little about the city. He knew even less about the large Irish-American population there. So he got off the train in Grand Central, got in the cab, and said, "Take me to Christ Church." And the cabbie, 7 minutes later, pulled up in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Well, he knew enough about the city to know that wasn't right, so he tapped him on the shoulder and said, "My good man, I think you've made a mistake. I want to go to Christ Church." And the cabbie looked at him and says, "If he's in town, he's here or no place." Of course, there could be some unfriendly souls that might suggest that my presence here today is sort of in line with the fellow who entered his mule in the Kentucky Derby. Someone asked him if he thought the mule had a chance to win, and he said no, he didn't expect anything like that, but he figured the association would do him good. You know, a century ago, an Englishman who didn't look too kindly on this experiment of ours here in America wrote a letter to an American friend. I think most of you are familiar with it. It's a, by now, very famous epistle. And this Englishman, Lord Macaulay, said to his friend, in the 5th century AD, ancient Rome was fearfully plundered by the Vandals and Huns. He said, in the mid-20th century, your republic will be plundered by the barbarians, but with this difference. Rome's barbarians came from without. Yours will have been engendered by your own democratic institutions. Now, perhaps what he had in mind was what another well-known man, a historian, Alexander Fraser Tytler, said. When he said democracy cannot succeed as a permanent form of government, it can only succeed until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse out of the public treasury. And from that moment on, he went on, the voter will always vote for the candidate promising the most benefits from the treasury, with the result that democracy always collapses over a loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by a dictatorship. Now, when Professor Tytler said that, it was 300 years ago, and he was commenting on the destruction of the Athenian Republic some 2,000 years before. Well, we've had warnings of this kind about our own society up to modern times, with a president pointing out to us that freedom is lost when the people decide the government can take care of them instead of them taking care of the government. And then to go back again 100 years, there was the great French philosopher de Tocqueville, who said, the end of freedom comes when the party in power learns it can perpetuate itself through taxation. Well, what does happen to freedom when the executive branch of government can use the money taken from the people in order to coerce the people? Is this a foolish fear? Recently, Representative Glenn Andrews introduced an amendment to the poverty legislation in Congress, and it's almost inconceivable that such an amendment was necessary. It's even more inconceivable that the amendment was rejected overwhelmingly, and it simply called for a rejection, this amendment, of the use of any of the poverty funds for political purposes. And I think it's time we recognize that this particular piece of legislation is in truth and reality a $1,800,000,000 campaign fund. 5 years ago, we reached a new frontier. Now we're face to face with a great society. Along the way, we've added $31 billion to our debt, but we've decreased our gold holdings to the point that there's fear for the solvency of our currency. And now the coins that shortly we will jingle in our pockets will no longer have the ring of silver. And something of a preposterous nature was reached when recently in a presidential press conference, we were assured with the announcement of these imitation coins that we need have no fear. The government stood behind them. The government would exchange them for paper anytime. We've discovered that every family with less than $3,000 a year income is poverty-stricken, but each family's share of government expense prorates out to $3,300. We've reached an all-time high in food prices, but the farmer's share of the market basket dollar, the man who produces the food, is lower than it has ever been in our history. And his debt in relation to income is higher than it has ever been in history, including on the eve of the 1929 Depression. And 5 years ago, there were no daily casualty lists, no wives and mothers receiving telegrams that began, "We regret to inform you." In the last campaign, we found our opponents presenting themselves as, forgive the expression, conservatives. Actually, if you review the last campaign, you will find that they were the ones who said, "We represent no change. We represent going along with this easy, peaceful, prosperous way." In short, they promised to maintain the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. We, on the other hand, were the radicals. We would bring about some drastic upheaval, some radical change. And now the wraps are off the great society, and a multitude of pieces of legislation have made it plain that we're to have a welfare state with an unprecedented federalization of American life. On June 30th, Congress raised the debt limit for the seventh time in 5 years. But our government spends $260 million a day, $10 million a day more than we were spending just last year. And we're told that we enjoy unprecedented prosperity. But the same government that tells us that tells us there are 42 government agencies now dispensing in public welfare a total of $70 billion a year. The pattern spreads. It took California 100 years to reach a $1 billion budget, and only 9 years to double that, and only 5 years to double that. When it reached $3 billion, we were told it was frugal. When it reached $3.5 billion, we were told it was an austerity budget. Now at $4 billion, too, we're told it's a bare-bones budget. Well, at last, they've said something we can understand and agree with, because we know whose bones are bare. Within the last several days, we have been told from Sacramento that within the state we must have an additional $200 million revenue in taxes, or we will go in the red. The excuse being given is the increase in population. Well, now everyone accepts that as you increase your population, of course, there are certain necessary services, expansion of the schools, expansion of water lines, sewer facilities, police protection, fire protection, all the rest. But since this administration took office in Sacramento, the population increase has been 28%, but the general fund expenditures have increased 103%, and total state expenditures are 10 times as great as the increase in population. Welfare expenditures in our state have increased 143%, and the per capita cost for every man, woman, and child in this state has gone from $32 to $62. Bob Stevens, our assemblyman, introduced a resolution, a piece of legislation that was favored even by the administrators of our welfare programs, that would have simply called for at least one personal interview with each recipient of welfare to establish that they were legitimately entitled to this and what their needs might be. And this particular piece of legislation was vetoed. The grand jury in 1963 did a research into state welfare, and they submitted a list of practical suggestions that could trim millions of dollars of cost from the administering of this program. No one has any intent of taking away from those who are truly in need the money they must have, and I'm sure that every responsible person, regardless of party, accepts his responsibility for his less fortunate neighbor. But at the same time, when the expense is pointed out, as was pointed out by the grand jury, in the administering of the program, and then this was pigeonholed, and now within the last few days, again, the grand jury has come down with virtually the same recommendations. And again, we wonder, will it be pigeonholed? This thing of spreading at government at every level, you know, it only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 people in this country to keep us well and healthy. 40 oil station attendants and mechanics for every 10,000 of us to keep our cars running. 37 telephone employees for this vast network of communications. And then we get to the federal government alone, and it takes 130 federal employees for every 10,000 of us. They outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states, including our own state of California. And with California, that's not too easy. You know, to show you how this can happen, there was a small town, it could happen, be true of any town, a small town in the East that decided to get in on the free surplus food handout from the federal government. Again, a good idea. If we can produce a surplus, it shouldn't be wasted. And what better purpose could be made than making this food available to the people who are in need and can't afford to buy it for themselves? But this small town that entered the program for its own needy found that pretty soon they were being snowed under with a load of audits and reports and forms that had to be filled out, until they awoke one day and discovered they had added so many employees to the city government just to handle the paperwork attended upon getting this free federal surplus food, that it was actually cheaper to drop the program and go back to buying the groceries retail at the corner grocery and dispensing it to their needy. Now we have a war on poverty. No one quarrels with that. I'm sure there isn't any one of us that would like to be like the fellow who heard about the war on poverty and went right out and threw a hand grenade at a beggar. But when they were getting the program, West Virginia became a household word. You'd have thought the whole war was going to be fought right there in West Virginia. There was the excuse for the program. Great distress and poverty and unemployment. So we have the bill. West Virginia gets $400,000. Texas gets $10 million. The president is fond of quoting from the scriptures. First Isaiah, the 18th verse. Come, let us reason together. Now that has a sort of a cozy, inviting sound, doesn't it? Let your eyes stray down a line or two into the next verses where it says, if ye refuse, ye shall be devoured with the sword. Sometimes it has seemed that when government invades areas that are not its normal province, that then the bureaus and the agencies of government begin to lose sight of the original goal. They're sort of like that soldier that won the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he'd been so lousy in basic training, no one could figure it out, so they asked his platoon sergeant how come, and he said, I just gave him a machine gun and told him he was in business for himself. How else can we explain such things as a government that tells us that we now only need 1 million large commercial farms to provide all our food and fiber, and then the same government at the same time says that any farm over 160 acres in size cannot get federal irrigation water? And down here in the Imperial Valley, for 30-odd years, those people have been exempt from the 160-acre limitation by an agreement with the federal government. And now the federal government has stepped in and said, as of January 1st, down to 160 acres or no water. And no voice is raised in Sacramento on their behalf, just as no voice was raised when they made the ridiculous decision canceling out the Bracero program. California agriculture was threatened with ruin, and the state government was more interested in being a little brother to Big Brother in Washington than in protecting the rights of its citizens. And so they backed Secretary of Labor Wirtz, who turned out to be something less than a jolly green giant. And then as the dominoes began to fall into place and the crops rotted in the fields and the price of foodstuffs rose to the all-time high, a voice was heard in Sacramento saying, well, the secretary's doing a difficult job. It isn't what our people think it should be, but he may be right. I think he's wrong, but he may be right. When Washington sneezes, the Gesundheit is heard in Sacramento. And all the plans they made to solve our problems, $125,000 of our money dispensed by the federal government for a training program to teach young people to pick tomatoes. The plans called for 2 weeks of training, and each young person would get $52 a week while he was being trained, plus room and board. And the $125,000 was for a school of 500 young people. 234 reported. Only about half of them completed the 2 weeks training, and then 90% of those that had completed it refused to take the jobs in the field and went home with their $104. Now, I've touched upon just a few specifics here for a reason. The reality is that the issues can be summed up really all in one big package, the first phase of which is the danger that we have today of losing a two-party system with this great imbalance in party, in power. And this certainly is an issue that crosses party lines and I'm sure must be of concern to Democrats as well as Republicans. And with this goes the great overall philosophical difference that divides our nation and our people today. Does man exist only by permission of and for the sake of the group, marching toward eternity in a super ant heap? Or does he control his own destiny? This question must be answered by all of us, regardless of party. And I would suggest that we have today the greatest appeal we've ever had within our party of appealing to people across a party line. To ask Democrats if they believe that the leadership of their party is following the precepts of Jefferson, Jackson, and Cleveland. Take the 1932 platform upon which Franklin Delano Roosevelt was elected, with its promise of a 25% cut in the cost of government, with its promise of returning to the states and the local communities and the individuals the constitutional rights that had been unjustly seized by the federal government, with the imposition once again of constitutional limits on the power of government, and ask which party today would be more at home with that particular platform and with those promises. I think I know something of the bond that people feel toward their party, because as was said here in the introduction, yes, I was a Democrat for many, many years, but I believe today that the leadership of the Democratic Party has betrayed the great rank and file of their party. Today, the Republican Party is the vehicle we must use as a party of opposition. Opposition to the misguided Democratic leadership at home and opposition to all the evil abroad that threatens the dignity and freedom of man in every land. And it's an awesome responsibility, and you and I can't meet it with a splintered party. May I pause right here, however, and say that you in this room who are members of this particular organization can be well proud of the part that you have played in seeking to unite the Republican Party. I know something of your purposes and I know something of your good work. And I would commend to those people present who are non-members, but who want to serve and who want to take part in the fight that confronts us today, that here you could find a very good battleground and a very good place for service by simply aligning yourselves with this organization. What we have to do is get rid of the labels that divide us. I'm sure within this room there are Republicans who would describe themselves as perhaps every shade of Republican, from liberal to moderate to conservative, whatever it might be. Let me suggest to you, and if you're not, each one of you has some friend who so describes himself, and perhaps you're at odds. Let me suggest that you sit down with that friend and drop the labels and just start discussing the specific issues that confront us today. And I think you'd be amazed to find out how much unites Republicans, how much we have in common, and how much or how little really separates us once we will drop those labels. The truth of the matter is, calling ourselves liberal Republicans, moderate Republicans, conservative Republicans, we're sucker Republicans. Those labels were given to us by our opponents, and we've gone along with it like sheep. It's time we bundled up the labels and the hyphens and gave them back and just started being Republicans. And then once we do this, then let's establish a set of principles. We don't have to agree in detail, and nor will we ever, on the actual specifics of how we're going to get things done. But I do know this, that there are general broad principles that we believe in, and broad principles we can use to appeal to all people today. I repudiate those, however, so, and I can understand their hunger for victory, who would have us imitate the opposition, who would have us adopt some spurious philosophy that is not ours and in which we do not basically believe. No, the only way that we can appeal to the great block of voters, which is the only block we should appeal to, is by adopting a statement of principles, by agreeing on certain things, and then the block of voters which I speak is a great block of unsung heroes in this country. They get up in the morning and go to work and send the kids to school. They pay their bills. They contribute to their church and charity. They believe that God was the author of their freedom and their rights. And most of them are pretty disturbed that their children can't ask God's blessing in a schoolroom anymore. This block is ours for the asking. If we'll tell them and make plain that we too have every intention of solving the problems of poverty and unemployment and distress and the things that divide us today, but we believe we can do this still paying heed to the spiritual nature of man and not just the material nature. And we believe we can do this without undue compulsion and fiscal irresponsibility. That we believe we can put a floor beneath which no American will be asked to live in degradation. But at the same time, we will not erect a ceiling above which no citizen can fly. without being penalized for his energy and his initiative. And on the world scene, I think we should stand brave and firm enough to say to them that we won't buy our security from the threat of the bomb by trading away the freedoms of people in other lands not ours to give. And yes, I think we should say to them that if their sons are going to be asked to die for their country, they'll be allowed to win. We and we alone in this moment can provide the vehicle which will preserve freedom and keep it from being lost in this, the last best hope of man on earth. And so I would suggest to every Republican, this is a time to look deep in his own heart and ask himself if there is any possible difference he could have with another Republican that is more important than the challenge facing us today. And if there is, then be prepared someday to see a book written with a title, The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. Now, I know that I have used up your time here, but I had promised, was asked if I would do this, and we did get running a little late here for a few moments at least to prove that I am lacking in intelligence but not in courage. I will submit myself to questions and try to field a few of them that you may have. If anyone has a question, I'll be very happy to try and answer. Yes, sir.
Can I ask Mr. Reagan what you regard as the most vital pressing problem in the state of California?
The question is, what do I regard as the most vital and pressing problem in the state of California? Well, I think it ties into the overall things that I've been mentioning here. I think in California today, we have seen a great tendency on the part of the present administration in Sacramento to view the state not so much as a sovereign body, but as an administrative district of the federal government, willing to abandon our sovereignty, take orders from and pass them on, and in turn, this is reflected, however, in that same state administration, and this is part of the, I believe, the feud with in their party at the upper levels, a tendency to bypass the legislature and to rule this state by administrative decisions, to pass down orders. And I would think that any responsible Republican today seeking one of the constitutional offices would may feel urged to promise that he would seek to restore autonomy to a greater extent in our cities and communities and at the local and county level. Particularly would this be true with the administration of welfare, that he would seek further to decentralize and get back into the hands of the local school boards our educational system. I think in the state college system there is a great need right now to do something that we've shown signs of doing in the university system, of giving the state college system more autonomy than they now have and getting rid of some archaic budget problems and rule. And this would be, this would touch upon crime and law enforcement. I think we need legislation such as our Assemblyman Duke Magian introduced, legislation which would have clarified that by the preemption of the state in certain areas of crime or law enforcement, that it was never intended that that preemption would tie the hands of local law enforcement officers to where they could not fully do their duty in protecting society. And again, this legislation should be passed, clarifying this so that our streets could become streets again instead of jungle paths. There are many other issues, but I think they could, basically, they stem from that problem. Is there perhaps another one? Yes, ma'am. The number of the state bill of Duke Magian's? Oh, golly, I can't, out of 5,000 of them, I can't give you the number of it, but I know that if I remember correct. Well, if not, I'm sure you could get it from Mr. Duke Magian's office. I know I have it at home. I can't recall the title or bill on it, but I know that it was pocket vetoed. Says, if you'll just see someone down here, the Republican Associates office will be able to hand it to you. And I know that's for sure. I've done a little calling myself for some answers to questions to the Republican Associates office.
Would you comment on the water situation between Northern and Southern California?
Oh, the water situation. No, you won't be here all afternoon. Well, I'll tell you, This, of course, is a field so big, and I think a lot of us get snowed under because of the great technicalities and the actual engineering facts, which none of us are able to cope with. I know one thing about the water situation. It is not true that Governor Brown discovered water. As a matter of fact, most people forget that that great big high dam over there was the brainchild of a man named Herbert Hoover. And against great opposition, he got it built. But I feel this way. It's a problem for great study, and I'm trying to do some on it. I am not sure that the present program that we are following is wise. It is projected so far ahead that one can't help but wonder if technological advances in the interim with regard to desalinization, for example, will not find us encumbered with some unnecessary structure and expense. But I start from this philosophy in the studying that I'm doing on it, that I say there any water system that we should use or that we should put into effect here must not be based on taking water away from the other part of the state, which will restrict them in their potential development, and that any water system must be based on the understanding that water will be adequate at any place in this state for their future development, so that just because we presently outnumber them, we have no right to make a water grab and forever sentence some areas to the state to never being able to realize their full potential. That isn't fair and shouldn't be done. I also have a feeling that the water shortage and the threat is not as great from the studies that I've done so far as we've been led to believe. Would I comment on the Birch Society? I'd rather just tell you that a couple of weeks ago I issued a complete statement, my own view on this and the problem as it affects the Republican Party, and I think that statement is available. I would make one available, or they're available from an office here in town at 1300 West Olympic Boulevard called the Friends for Ronald Reagan. The gist of that statement, I don't mind saying, is, and I realize that perhaps I'm asked this question because recently I seem to have been the center of supposedly a plot or a conspiracy for soliciting support. And this is not true. I made the mistake of trying to get a laugh by repeating a facetious line that I had heard someone else had made. The truth of the matter is, I am not a member myself. I have no intention of becoming a member. I have never sought Birch Society support, nor will I. And my statement refers to the investigation of the Society by our Senate Fact-Finding Committee report and their findings. The truth is, I do not believe that the Birch Society is a Republican problem. This is a nonpartisan, by their own admission, roughly 50-50 Democrat and Republican organization. They do not endorse political candidates at all as an organization. And, I sometimes think that all the questions that keep being thrown at all Republicans with regard to what we possibly feel we must do about an outside organization that is not a part of our structure is sort of like the old adage of the horse trader. Now, horses are my business, and I know this old rule that when a fella comes trading a horse, you watch to see what part of your horse he looks at first, and then you go look at his horse at that same place, because that's probably where it's weak. I think the Democrats don't want us asking some embarrassing questions about the CDC and some of the things going on at Berkeley with their personnel. There was a gentleman right there.
Would you comment on the reapportionment, if there's a chance of reversing it?
Well, the only chance I know of reversing it must come about through a constitutional amendment. I, of course, favored very much, and I'm sure all of us should have, the Dirksen Amendment, because I believe that the Supreme Court decision with regard to reapportionment was probably a decision that was more contrary to the intent of the Constitution than any decision that has ever been passed down in our history. They had I believe, no constitutional right whatsoever to invade the sovereignty of the state in the manner that they did. And the great danger is, once we get reapportionment, it's going to be pretty hard to get rid of it then, because you will then be in the position of asking legislators to vote themselves out of jobs. But this is what adds to the responsibility of Republicans. This is going on now under a very heavy Democratic majority. In 1970, we will be up for reapportionment again under the terms of our Constitution. And if that party is in power again when that takes place, I don't expect to live long enough to see a Republican victory in this state, if they get a second crack at it in a few years, to reapportion and gerrymander this state. So to me, the watchword for our party, and the word above all, must be win. But the states were brought into the Union, some of them like Connecticut, with a constitution that antedated our own constitution by almost 100 years. And they were accepted. And the only constitutional clause is that each state must come in with a Republican form of government. And now for the federal government to turn around and literally dictate what this is going to result in, I think, maybe this was the purpose, I don't know, but this is going to result in rule by big city machines throughout the entire nation. Is there perhaps time for one? Yes, sir. Have I any idea when I may make an announcement about myself? Well, I've never been very sure of when the snow flies in the Sierras. I have said recently I am willing to be a candidate, but I have wanted to make sure that I would not be preaching unity and at the same time by my actions then doing something that might not serve to unify the party. We've had too many primaries in this state where candidates go into the fight with a faction and with other people that they know in advance are so unalterably opposed that there is no chance of our party unifying in the general campaign. And so I've wanted to make sure that this would not be the case this time. I have been getting as far as I can around the state, and I'm going to continue to do so. I would think, just on geography and the places I still want to go and the people I still want to talk to, that probably midwinter, sometime late December I should have the answers that I need. I don't mind telling you, I'm very close to the edge of the porch, but you keep 1 foot back. Is there perhaps time for one? I know I'm keeping way beyond your time. One more, and then, yes, ma'am. The principal function of government? I think the principal function of government, and this is what made this experiment in this country so much greater and so unique, so different than anything we've ever known before. The function of government is to see that no individual in our midst, no group, or no outside force can impose on freedoms which we, for the first time, said were ours by right of birth, God-given, that they are not. I think it can be summed up in two clauses of the Constitution, one of which is in the Soviet Constitution and one in our own. They're matching. They both promise the people the right of free expression, assembly, meeting, and so forth. And you can say, well, wherein lies the difference? Well, the difference is so great and yet so subtle it almost escapes us. The Soviet Constitution says, we, the government, give you these rights. And our Constitution says, you have these rights and no government can take them from you. And I think the primacy, the supremacy of the individual, is the basis of our government. And we must never distort that responsibility of all of us collectively to guarantee the rights of even the least individual among us. We must never change that over and distort it to the greatest good for the greatest number, because then we have mobocracy. We have mob rule if there isn't that set of ground rules protecting the individual. Then we say 50% of the people plus one can do whatever they want to the rest simply because they outnumber them. And I feel that we're in great danger today of doing just exactly that. There is less and less respect for the individual, and there must be. The greatness of our form of government is that the Bill of Rights said that our unalienable rights could never be submitted to a vote. We cannot submit to majority rule the rights that are ours by birth. And this we must not lose. No matter how high-sounding the phrase of one man, one vote, greatest good for the greatest number. And once government and the law stops respecting the individual is going to stop respecting government and the law. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. And I know that Steve has a couple of important announcements for you. You've been very kind, and I'm very grateful to you.
Thank you very much, Ronald Reagan. It's a wonderful talk. I know all of you enjoyed it as much as I did. A couple of quick thoughts. The next luncheon meeting of Republican Associates will be on November 9th, when we will present Minority Leader of the House of Representatives, Congressman Gerald Ford. This will be his only Los Angeles appearance at this time, and I know you'll have the most interesting report on this session of Congress. I'm also pleased to announce that we will begin the 1966 campaign year with a Lincoln Day luncheon on February 15th, when our speaker will be our new senator from California, George Murphy. Please mark your calendar. And the score is 5-0 in the top of the fifth. Top of the seventh, the Twins, I'm sorry to report. Thanks for coming. See you next month.
Yeah, I got that.